Inside this room, we're in the world of non-duality. Now we understand everything, we're one with everything. We even understand the world of duality because we're non-dual. Non-dual meaning there's no separation. You know, this is a very simple definition of non-duality. There's no separation of anything. It's all one total unity.
Welcome back to Religion to Reality, the podcast about living an integrated life. I'm your host, Dave Plisky, and I'm joined by my friend and co-host, Father John Gribowich. This season is all about listening, and so we, as Catholics, are listening to voices from outside our tradition. We're hearing from all kinds of faith traditions this season, and today is our second and final episode with Taoism. And I love how different they are from one another, while being totally complementary. Last episode, we heard from Ming Dao Deng, a Taoist who lives a very integrated life between mind, body, and spirit, though places a greater emphasis on the philosophy of the Tao than on the traditional rituals or spiritual celebrations. In this episode, Michael Rinaldini gives us kind of an overview of both the spiritual side, that particularly around meditation, as well as some of the rituals, him being a priest, a Taoist priest, that they go through. Early on in the episode, I ask Michael to explain the Tao, and he basically says, no, I can't, which is kind of funny. But that's more or less why we had Ming Dao go first. So if you haven't heard the previous episode, you should probably start there. But there's a point at which Michael does start discussing Taoist concepts such as non-duality, pre-heaven and post-heaven, yin and yang, unity and emptiness. And so he's kind of effectively answering my question later on in the episode, but you can hear me laugh, because I'm just so totally lost. And so maybe that's why he said he couldn't explain it to me, but I hope that you can stay with Michael when we get there. Today, we are joined by Shifu Michael Rinaldini, who's the director of the Qigong and Taoist Training Center in Sebastopol, California. He was ordained in China as a 22nd generation Taoist priest in 2003 and founded the American Dragon Gate lineage in 2006, which is a Taoist non-monastic lineage. He offers advanced training and certification in Qigong and Taoist practices nationally and internationally. Shifu Michael's early years on the spiritual path included 6 years of intermittent retreats to Catholic and contemplative monasteries throughout the United States. Some of these visits included 3 months at Christ in the Desert Monastery in New Mexico, 2 stays at the Cartusian Monastery in Vermont, and various Trappist monasteries. He also explored the various Buddhist traditions, Zen, Vipassana, and Tibetan Buddhism. It was not until Shifu Michael found the Qigong and Taoist path in his early 40s that he found his home. And yet, he periodically returns to the Catholic contemplative tradition for inspiration and support, like his one-month retreat at New Camaldoli Heritage in Big Sur, California in 2022. He later became an oblate of New Camaldoli Hermitage. Since 2013, he has written 7 journal books on his experiences, including his last journal book, A Taoist Practice Journal, Interreligious Dialogue, Taoism and Christianity, Extraordinary Vessels, and Taoist Cultivation in 2023. Michael, it's really great to have you on the show. Welcome.
Thank you for having me here.
So I have to point out right away that you and John have some common experience, especially at the New Camaldoli Hermitage in Big Sur, where John, I know you spent some time there, and then also at their kind of urban monastery in Berkeley.
Yeah, and actually, I was looking at when you said that you were there for a month in 2022. I was also there for about 2 months in 2022. So I don't know if we were there at the same time, but I was there all of Lent that year.
Oh, yeah. I was there before Lent. I was there mainly the month of February.
Okay. Yeah. So we just missed each other there.
Same building.
Well, we could have been in the same hermitage. Yeah. Yeah, that's a really special place there in Big Sur. I'm based in San Francisco, so I'm not too far from there.
Oh yeah, yeah, and I'm up here in Sebastopol. So, but
yeah, not far at all. I've been there. Yeah, it's great. We're neighbors. That's so cool.
So Michael, I'd love to just kind of hear your story, if you wouldn't mind sharing it. You know, just how you grew up, especially your spiritual journey and how that's gone along for you.
Well, I mentioned that it was not until my early 40s that I kind of got seriously involved with Qigong and Taoist practice. But when I started my first writing project in 2013, my first question was, where did this path really begin? What were my early inspirations? And so it turns out that this path for me started when I was back in high school, reading The Razor's Edge. And that was my first exposure that there was something more than the ordinary. And so there were big jumps from that experience to when I went away to college in 1969. I was exposed to Zen practice, had some deep experiences that kept inspiring me to continue staying with it, exploring different things. So by that time I had, like, I guess when I left home in Long Island, New York, I kind of basically left the Catholic Church. But I left it with not intentionally leaving, and I just didn't think about it anymore.
Had you grown up Catholic, by the way?
I did.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. Went through the traditional route. When I became more interested in spirituality when I was in college in Oklahoma, it was mainly through Zen practice. And then, you know, jumping ahead after 2 years at college, it was right at that peak time of the end of the Vietnam War. And I was pretty radical on the Oklahoma campus. And then when things started to quiet down, I realized, oh, it's time for me to move on, even though I didn't really make much progress in my college studies. And so I ended up leaving there, and I went to Florida, where my family had migrated or moved to. And then I got involved with a yoga group, which led me to going to India, which led me back to the States, going to a Vedanta monastery up in Chicago, Michigan area. And then it was there that things started changing. It was a little monastic community, men only, and I was pretty free to do whatever I wanted to do, to a degree, to my studies and what I was interested in. And somehow I started reading Thomas Merton. I'm not sure if that's where I discovered him, but it's possible that's where I discovered the writings of Thomas Merton. And then the lives of different saints, Catholic saints. So I had here I am in a Vedanta monastery in Michigan, and I had a reconversion back to Catholicism. So then I left there. I went to my sister's home family in North Carolina, and my intention was a short time there, but it ended up taking me 6 years before I moved out of North Carolina. And in the process, then I kind of like realized, oh, this maybe it's the Catholic monastic path that I'm interested in. And so I became friends like 20 miles away from where I lived in Raleigh. There was a little, what do they call it? A little annex of, there were three Trappist monks that were living there. And so I became friends with them, went there kind of frequently. And so I got more knowledge about the Catholic monastic tradition. And then from there, that's when I began going out to different Catholic monasteries. I discovered Christ in the Desert Monastery. I visited there, and then I went back for a 3-month, I think what they call it, observer period. And that wasn't for me. Then I came back to North Carolina, and then I went explored the Carthusians up in Vermont. And that was like, it was too radical of a shock for me. it was too solitary, too. I mean, it was beautiful and it was ideal, but and I went back like one time, 1 year, and then I went back the following year, or maybe a couple of years later. They kept on giving me chances of checking out whether that was my path, but I kept on realizing it was too much solitude, and maybe a little bit more rigid than what I was anticipating of as living as a an American monk. So I kept on going to other places. Being I was on the East Coast, I mainly focus on East Coast monasteries. And then, so then what an interesting part of that is, while I was being so-called on the Catholic monastic path, I also went back to my early experiences in Zen. So, and then I was hooking up or getting familiar with other Catholic monks that were also Zen practitioners. Very much following in the Thomas Merton tradition. I felt like I was like 2 years or 3 years behind where Merton was in his travels. Like I would go to a place and they would say, oh, this is the room that Thomas Merton stayed in. Or even at Christ in the Desert, Merton checked them out as well. So I'm not sure if I was in the cabin that Merton was in. So I felt like, and many of these older monks were colleagues or, you know, peers with Thomas Merton. So I was almost getting it, you know, straight out of the mouth of Merton through his writings and through other monks that, you know, grew up with him. So then I finally found my last in Conyers, Georgia, the Trappist Monastery. I settled down there. And then again, it happened. I wasn't satisfied with where I was. And then maybe my final realization was, after all these years, maybe I really don't want to be a monastic monk. Maybe I just want to be on the spiritual path. So that was, I think, somewhere in 1979. So then I left and I kind of took care of business. And then before you know it, I was in Boston. And then I kind of like never looked back, in a way of like, I never had this serious interest in becoming a monk again. And then just, so from there, I kind of went back into my Zen practice and then other Vipassana practice. After 6 years of living in Boston, I was still in that tradition. And then I moved to the Berkeley, San Francisco area. And then because of some minor health problems, I ended up getting into Qigong in Chinese medicine. And then I was like discovering the Taoist path for the first time, even though I've very other similar paths. But then, so when I was around 40 years old, I was really settled, kind of like got a new job, was settling, met a person who became my wife in a very short time, moved up to Sebastopol and just continued with my Qigong studies and my Taoist practices and learning a lot more. And going, again, this time I was going around different parts of the country, but to study with different Taoist teachers. One of those trips brought me to China for my first time. And then on my second visit, there was a Taoist priest there that was temporary in residence at the Qigong center that I was at. So it just like, okay, I met him. Then the following year, that old question came back to me, like, oh yeah, I wanted to be a monk. I wanted to be a Zen priest. Now I want to be a Taoist a priest. And so my obstacle was, well, there aren't many options in this country. And I explored, made, I had already a number of connections with other teachers around the country, but very, very few Taoist priests that could really train me, ordain me in the tradition. So that took me back to China, where that priest that I met ended up ordaining me in that 2003 in Beijing, and then kept up a little bit of a connection with him, continuing my studies and practices. And then in 2006, then I was given permission to start training and ordaining others. And so that's when I officially founded the American Dragon Gate lineage. And
wow.
So that's where I am now. I have a number of students that have trained, ordained, you know, a good number have left, just like any other religious tradition or path. But I just had a retreat like a couple of weeks ago with a good number of my priest students. And so we were 22 people there on retreat. So this was our 20th anniversary since 2006.
Could you give us like a little bit of a window of what those retreats look like? How they structured and what do you try to integrate?
Well, the core of the retreats is the meditation. In the Taoist tradition, there's a meditation method or tradition called a Zouan. That's Zouwang. The translation into English, it means sitting and forgetting. So it's part of the apophatic tradition that crosses, you know, different religious paths. But it's a very deep form of meditation. There's what we call now no walking sticks involved, which means like things we hang on to, you know, things like mantras, you know, reciting things. So it's all about getting free of all of that. And so the retreats, that's the core. So it's a very structured retreat. And then it's integrated with different Qigong practices. And the Qigong practices kind of foster the meditation aspect. So they go together. And, you know, I've been doing these annual retreats with students for the last 15 years. So I've been through a lot of retreat centers in the area. And I've been through many kind of variations, but it's all about the Qigong that encourages the meditation part. There's a big aspect of, you know, all of these Taoist concepts, like this important Taoist concept called the heart mind. So the Qigong practices and the Taoist practices are really focused around purifying the heart mind. And at the base, the origin or the center of the heart mind is our pure nature. You know, in the Taoist tradition, it's called our Xing, X-I-N-G, or innate nature. And so it's all about, you know, going into that realm of quietness, stillness, a very related tradition is called clarity and stillness. There's a scripture called the clarity and stillness scripture. And so between that and the Zouan, sitting and forgetting, we have some specialties that have developed over the years. On the retreats is the only time that I do any priest ordinations. So sort of in the middle of the retreat, I'll have a priest ordination for whoever is eligible at that point.
How long does it take for one to be ordained? What does that process look like?
Well, right now it's usually, say if someone does not have a Qigong background, then they would take my Qigong training program, which is almost a year, and then at some point, or maybe at the end, then if they wanted to go the route of being a Taoist priest, then it begins with a 9-month novice period, and it's like any other novice period training among the different traditions. It's a trial. It's an introduction to some of the core things, the core aspects, the history, some of the basic practices. But underlying that is, oh, this is your time to get to know me, get to know the lineage, and make your own discernment of, do you want to commit more? Do you want to continue? So if a person finishes the 9 months, then it begins what's called a 1,000-day training period. And so then for 1,000 days, which is roughly 2.5 years, then it's more studies, coming to the Mahayana retreats. They also have to go on retreats at other places where, so it's like distant learning, but so there's a lot of scholarly studies. They have to go on a certain number of their own solitary retreats wherever they live. And that's usually my first suggestion is there a Catholic monastery close by you can go to? Because those are the best places. Basically, you're as a guest. You can do whatever you want as far as your own practice. You can join the monasteries and their services. But that's the place where you're basically going to be able to continue your training as a Taoist practitioner.
Sounds like Qigong practices are a big part of it. Can you tell us more about that? So does that include, you know, breathing practices, moving practices, still practices? This is, you know, our audience is largely Christian, so they may not be very familiar. And I'm just curious if you could tell us more about those.
Well, it's all, people know about Tai Chi. They may or may not know about Qigong. A good number of people know about Chinese medicine because a lot of people have been to acupuncturists for acupuncture, herbs, lifestyle suggestions. And then there's the, like, what we would call the core Taoist practices. Those are all one system. They're not separate things. And people specialize, you know, a number of my priest members are acupuncturists. So they've been through their master's or PhD programs in Chinese medicine. And I have 4 or 5 of those members that have been with me for a while. So it's all part of the big path, which started, you know, we don't even really know when it started, but it started in the early shamanic period of Chinese history. And then that became, as that developed, and as the Chinese civilization developed, that was the beginning of Chinese medicine, when these early sages were picking roots out of the ground and seeing what ailments were helped so and so. So that was the beginning of Chinese medicine. And then the movements, it wasn't called Qigong until very recently, but they were the beginning of movements, stories of, they were mimicking the natural movements of animals. And then Qigong forms were created, like the 5 animal frolics. It's one of the oldest Qigong forms, but then it just kept on developing. And then the whole path of Chinese medicine kept on developing. And along with that was the religious, the spiritual practice. So they're all one system with different emphasis. So Qigong is a little bit of all of that. The longer you stay in Qigong, the more you learn about Chinese medicine, the whole works. You're not an acupuncturist unless you go to acupuncture school. And then It's hard not to stay in Qigong practice without exploring the Taoist path as well, because it's my own personal feeling is if you want to be a really good Qigong practitioner or teacher, healer, you also need to go into the meditation part, because how can you go deep into these healing energies without the process of the silence and the stillness that is cultivated?
Can you give us, without getting too much into the history, just a brief overview of what the Taoist tradition is all about?
Well, I really can't. I can't because it's too long of a story, and there's too many side stories. All I can say is there's a lot of variety and different directions in Catholicism, which we all know about. In Taoism, there's probably tenfold more of those directions. There's no central authority. Like I was ordained by a priest in the monastic lineage. I was not even asked, do I? The subject didn't even come up. Like, well, we know you're already married, and we know you're not going to come to China to live in a temple, but I'm going to ordain you as a Taoist priest. So that's just from the Catholic tradition, we know that's very different from that path. So there's a lot of, the history is very, very broad, very deep.
When we hear, Tao, what does it mean to you? Because I know it can be very ambiguous, and I guess there's a lot of subjectivity around it. But what would characterize that?
Well, there are different traditions that have gone and different emphasized different things. Like there's traditions that emphasize the ritual practices, and then there's traditions that emphasize like the tradition that I evolved out of the meditation practices. They all have the upper levels, or the it's hard to not use the word goal, but the goal in all of those different Taoist paths is to attain unity, alignment with the Tao. The Tao is the highest principle, and so that's the path, or the Tao means the Tao is the principle, but it also means Tao translated as also means the way. So the way and the end of the way are considered both the Tao. It's a very non-dualistic system. So even when talking in simple terms about the way and the Tao, they're not two separate systems. And in fact, the Taoist view is that there's no separation among anything in the universe. So the divine and the human are the same. The presence of the indwelling spirit is not separate from us. So if you Father John, if did you read the you must have read the Bernard wait
Again?
Bernard Barnhart.
Oh, Barnhart. Yeah.
Yeah, is when I was there.
Bruno. Yeah.
Yeah, Bruno. Yeah, so I read a number of his books when I was there, and his and he even talks about him and others in similar line talk about how the apophatic tradition is what unites the Asian religions with the Christian Western religions.
Right.
And so that was a like well that was really interesting reading that he was writing about the divine and the human. Like he wouldn't even say that there's just the divine, The human is part of the divine.
Right.
And his I was just reviewing a couple of things that I wrote about, that his concept of the unitive vision, that's non-duality. That's the Taoist path. So,
Right.
well, that's the common ground.
Isn't it even interesting that, in the New Testament, Acts of the Apostles, the early Christians are considered members of the way?
Way, yeah.
I mean, and there's something extremely the expansive understanding of the incarnation, which was very Bruno, like he like understanding that the incarnation isn't just an event that's happening in the person of Jesus. It's the entire cosmos. Everything is caught
Exactly.
up in the
Exactly.
incarnation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the things you mentioned, the non-dualistic nature of Taoism. And my understanding is that in China, where it had its origins, for many, many centuries, people are often they don't they live their life with a kind of blending of Confucianism, Taoism, and Buddhism without any perceived in contradiction or anything like that. It's just parts of who you are, and you may look through a particular lens when you encounter some part of your life, but there's no sort of need to think about, am I this or am I that? You just these they're just drawing wisdom from any one of these kind of streams of traditions that when we study them, we look at them as discrete, but the lived reality is that they're not. And I just wonder if that's if you know I know that so you're in your bio we mentioned that you're an oblate at the New Camaldoli, and I wonder if that's similar for you, where you don't you don't see your maybe you don't say I am a Catholic and I am a Taoist. You just I am, and these are the traditions I'm drawing from. I just wonder how you think about that.
Pretty close to that. But going back to how you started, when I was in China, just meeting, ordinary people, not the teachers or the priests. And then walking around in these little towns, these little towns are full of different kinds of temples, the Buddhist monastery, Taoist temple. You'd have to dig deeper to go into the Confucian temples. That just wasn't my interest. But I heard many, many times over and over again, today we're going to church. I'm sure they didn't use that word, but they say, in the morning we're going to offer incense at the Taoist temple, have lunch, and then in the afternoon we're going to go over to the Buddhist temple, offer incense. So that was. Yeah, so they don't make that big distinction that we do here in this country or in the West in general. And so that's kind of like I'm a little bit, well, a lot more structured than that. Clearly I have my Taoist roots, I have my Catholic roots. If you read, if you go through my journals, they're all about that interchange, the interaction. My past is constantly coming up. I go on local retreats. Maybe Father John, maybe Sky Farm Hermitage. And
I'm going there in May. I go there very often.
yeah, so that's one of my local favorite place. And I have these great conversations with Sister Michaela there. She treats me the same way. It doesn't matter that I'm not a churchgoer. She knows my roots. She knows me. That's the key thing. She knows me, who I am. And we are very much, and she's been through different traditions as well, with her roots in India, in the sannyasin tradition. The B. Griffin. So yeah, so on one level I'm a Taoist priest, a Qigong teacher, but I have Easily can have a conversation with someone about the cloud of unknowing. I t write about frequently in my books, the apophatic tradition, Thomas Merton. So I'm at home in all of those places.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I resonate so much with that. Well, tell me a little bit about what you can, your perspective on how, like, say, a church-going Catholic may even deepen their own sense of, say, the Christian mystery by kind of just kind of, you know, wading the water in say the traditions that the other traditions that are non-Christian that you've kind of have been able to experience. Like, how does that benefit a Catholic from your perspective?
Well, because they're going to the core of what Christianity is. You know, what was the first the major, the serious following of Christ, you know, right after those first couple hundred years? It was the monastic rising up in the deserts there, the early the Christian hermits. That was the big, you know, impetus to keep the movement going, you know. And then, you know, from my own, you know, studies and reading, people were flocking to those hermits to learn the Jesus story. And then how can we imitate that? So that was the beginning of Christian, you know, Christian, maybe real deep Christian prayer, you know, the prayer that you have, you know, that you're going to find in the desert, the silence and the solitude. And so for modern day, present day people that are not turned on by the Sunday church going process, but they're always saying, I always hear the expression, I'm not religious, but I'm spiritual. So, well, where are you going to get that spiritual inspiration from if you're not going to get it by going to your local church? And my advice is, find your local Catholic monastery and go there on retreats. And then you'll see what it's like, what these monks have dedicated their lives, monks and nuns have dedicated their lives to, you know, seeking that experience of the desert in the monastery. You know, what is silence? What is stillness? That's where they're going to find their real inspiration. And whether they come back to the local church doesn't matter to me. But they may feel, oh, this is my Catholic identity in the monastery. What's they've been doing? And then that just, you know, then that leads to reading more about it, reading more about the modern day, these writings, you know, all of Merton's books and everyone that has followed in that tradition, the whole centering prayer. I mean, that the monastic, you know, Merton, you know, talking about that, the Jesus prayer. You know, I went, you know, I've been through all of those traditions. Sometimes I was practicing the Jesus prayer, letting that lead to the Zoan, you know, conceptual method of prayer, the apophatic tradition, but not present, you know, recently, but that used to be how I would practice. Start off at a meditation center with the Jesus prayer, and then let go of that, and then it's sort of like the silent prayer.
Yeah, beautiful.
One of the things that that draws me, you know, I first read the Tao Te Ching when I was in college, and even though I was still an active Catholic at the time, it was really, it felt very resonant to me. It felt very important and helpful even. And one of the things that's been drawing me to what you're talking about, Michael, is how embodied the practices can be in Taoism and in Qigong. And I just wonder, and even when you told your story, you know, it was so location. You were all over the place. I mean, you really were searching, and you were using your feet to get there, right? It wasn't just in your mind or something.
A lot of buses.
Yeah, I wasn't trying to say he walked across country.
Yeah, I couldn't afford the plane, but I was on long Greyhound bus trips.
Right. But I just wonder if that's can be something helpful for Christians maybe who are you know, who, so we hear a lot about meditation, and we might even practice Eastern meditation practices, breathing practices, etc. But I wonder, like, how can someone get more involved in the moving practices of Qigong or of Tai Chi that might involve more of the body in a meditational way?
Well, I mean, there's wherever the listeners are, there are local Tai Chi teachers, there are local Qigong teachers. Basically, we're all over the place. But what's interesting, as a Qigong teacher, I offer a certification program, and so this is, I have students all over the place, including other countries. But I very often get someone writing to me, you know, emails saying, "There's no Qigong teacher in my area." It's not hard to believe that because I've heard it so many times. So then I say, well, if you do my training, then you'll be able to, you know, be that Qigong teacher in that little section of the world where you live in. So Qigong is very accessible. Tai Chi is very accessible as well. They're out of the same tradition, but there are differences. And my personal personally favor the Qigong practices, but I have nothing against the Tai Chi tradition. It's just like, well, what's your preference? And there are a million books, so, you know, just start reading. One problem that I see is people coming to me and they list a whole bunch of books and videos that they've been trying to learn Qigong from, and that's challenging because there's so many different approaches to Qigong as well as Tai Chi, and so they really end up with knowing very little because they've just been fractured in learning from a lot of different places. So they really have to. The best route is, you know, find a local teacher, check them out. Every Qigong teacher says, you know, when you're making a recommendation for someone else that is not able to study with you, you got to check them out. There's people at all different levels of skill. And that's what Qigong, the gong, means, skill. So you want to find a skillful teacher. And that's the best way to go. You can learn a lot from books. But you'll learn more from a teacher. So first you
from
find
doing, right?
What was that?
From doing it, from actually starting to
from
practice.
From doing it. First find a good teacher and then read the books, because the books will provide the theory and the principles and the background and broaden your experience.
Mm-hmm. Is it the case that there are, you know, Taoists who are really more Taoist in, philosophically, more rather than religiously? Now you are an ordained priest, but is it the case that some people merely follow, you know, kind of the teachings, so to speak, without the religious practices?
Well, you're bringing
and
up
do you think that's a valid you know, kind of approach?
There's two big views on that, and then there's another big view that people that are making those distinctions don't know what they're talking about. Not literally. So there's the
that's getting spicy.
yeah. I mean, there's a lot going on. There's a lot of things about all of this. But so they say the philosophical Taoists mainly focus on a couple of the core Taoist books, like the Tao Te Ching and the Chuanzi. And then the other group, they kind of bridge the gap between religious and spiritual, and they actually do more, from my point of view, they do more of the practice. There's a number of Taoist scholars in this country when they're talking about the practice or the teachings, they frequently refer to themselves as being scholar practitioners or academic practitioners, to indicate that they are academics or scholarly, but they're also practitioners. So they're not just into the philosophy of the Tao Te Ching, they're interested in, well, what's the practice that goes with that? So that's where I'm at. There's the philosophy, the religion, the spirituality of these core teachings, but the practice is just as important, or maybe more important, depending on how you want to look at that. Because if you're just into reading the Tao Te Ching and appreciating and learning all of the principles that are in the Tao Te Ching, but you never sit down and you never get into your own stillness or your own emptiness, which the Tao Te Ching talks about constantly, well, how are you gonna then? It's just an intellectual thing. A lot of scholars are. Have a reputation of being very intellectual about the area of expertise. But how many of them are actually practitioners of what they're talking about? So that's an important thing to realize.
So you mentioned the silence and the emptiness, and I think you used the term that you need to be able to go there, go into there. What does it mean? What does it mean to go into your own emptiness, and how do you hold that with at the same time as holding kind of the dignity of every human that we learn through the Christian tradition?
Well, it's, big part of it is the unity. We threw out that word, unitive vision, and we threw out the word non-duality, and I threw in the word the Zoan. And the silence and the stillness, at the core of all of that is this emptiness. I mean, that's this the, just like in any path, there's a lot of different terms and terminology that goes along with the description of all the phases, the processes. At the center is the I am, getting to know yourself. I'm just, I can go off in so many different directions. I think that the core of who and what we are wants to know more about that same thing, who and what we are. There's a core ingredient in all of us that wants, that old concept, self-fulfillment, self-realization. And some people are more aware of that, and then some people are a lot more aware of that, and that's what leads to what, eventually, if we kept on talking for hours and hours here, we would end up talking about, well, what is the mystical experience? What is that core reality realization? So eventually we would get talking about that, but since we're not talking for hours here, I think it's that deep experience that unites us all. I'm not even sure what your question is anymore.
I was asking, you know, you mentioned the emptiness. I just, I've heard some pretty satisfying explanations from the Buddhist tradition of how non-self is not at odds with the self, the selfhood, the dignity of self taught in the Christian tradition. And I was wondering if there was a same non-competitiveness or non-duality to the idea of this, of the need to go into one's own emptiness and but still retaining the dignity of the self.
Well, what if I talk about non-duality and duality?
Sure.
That may be at the heart of what your mm-hmm. question is. So one day, in the previous place where I lived here in Sebastopol, I had a meditation room. And so some of my local students would come to my meditation, to my house for an evening of meditation, as opposed to my local Qigong classes. And then so I had this one student that was with me for a relatively short time, but he was wanting to go on the Buddhist path. And so one night after our meditation at my house in my meditation room, we come out standing on my patio, and he was struggling with this idea, duality and non-duality. And so it just popped into my head, maybe the best way to demonstrate or explain to him what these experiences are and how they're different. I said, well, okay, so we're outside. I'm outside on the patio, and look around. This is the world of duality. We see ourselves, our body, you know, our fingers. We look around with the trees and the house and other people here. That's the world of non-duality. That's the world of duality. But we know there's this concept of non-duality, and we know it's very different from the world of duality. But while we're out here talking and looking around, we can only know of the concept of non-duality. We can't experience it because we're in this mist of non-duality, you know, what the Buddhists may call the 10,000 things. So okay. Now so everyone else had left. So now we walk back into the meditation room, and I say, inside this room, we're in the world of non-duality. So now we understand everything. We're one with everything. We even understand the world of duality because we're non-dual. Non-dual meaning there's no separation. You know, there's a very simple definition of non-duality. There's no separation of anything. It's all one total unity. And so then we go back out on the patio. Now we're in the world of duality. And now we just have a little glimpse or a trace of understanding of non-duality because we just came out of it. But we really don't know, understand, and can experience non-duality when we're in duality. If we want to, we have to go back into the meditation room, into the realm of non-duality.
And that is the realm of non-duality because that's the place that you are doing the meditation, where you're able to get into that place.
Well, that's where we are doing the preparation.
Okay.
So another concept, and this is more of a Taoist, typical Taoist way of describing this. There's the pre-heaven realm, and then there's the post-heaven realm. So these are big Taoist concepts.
Okay.
So it all has to do with the Tao, the one. The one became the two. That's the begin. The yin and the yang. The yin and the yang came from what's called the Tai Chi. The Tai Chi is the unity of the yin and the yang. So the big mystery is, what caused this unity, call it the one or the Tai Chi, to separate? So that's part of like, Well, we don't know the what the motivation for the Big Bang. We don't know that motivation. So, you can just keep on saying, well, we don't know why, if there was this God divinity somewhere, why that divinity wanted how it came to be about this physical universe. So this the original Tai Chi, the original unity, is all in this realm of pre-heaven. Something made that pre-heaven Tai Chi unity create the world of post-heaven, or a nice little simple word that we're all familiar with is manifestation. So the manifestation came from pre-manifestation or pre-heaven, pre-existence. Something made that become the manifestation, which was the beginning, the first creation of the yin and the yang, and from the yin and the yang, everything else was created. It's almost like looking at the screen, being that we're just two of us right now. We have this like green line separating your box from my box. So that line is the portal. So I'm going to say you're the realm of pre-heaven. So if I go from my box here over past that portal, that line, into your realm of pre-heaven, unity, emptiness, is a lot of words that describe that state. Then we're in the world of non-duality.
Wow.
And that's the process. So the process becomes there's like a top down and then there's a down up. So the top is like the Tao, the one, the unity, and then it manifests itself through the Tai Chi becoming the yin and the yang. The yin and the yang produce everything else. That's the post-heaven realm. So that's sort of like, well, that's the description of what's called Taoist cosmology. And then the Taoist path is we start at the bottom, like where we are right now, work our way back up to the top.
Wow. Listeners, if you are still here, God bless you. I'm struggling along here with you. I think I understood about a tenth of what you just said, Michael, but I'm definitely going to listen back and try to go there with you better. Let me ask you one more question. Since you are a priest, what role does ritual play in Taoism, and why is it important?
Well, then I have to talk out of two sides of my mouth, because the path I'm in is known as the complete perfection, or the Quanzhen, Quanzhen, known as the complete perfection. That was one of the major religious orders that started in the 12th century. And that's one of the still, and then there were branches. They were founded by an individual who then had disciples, and then they continued the spreading of this particular pathway. So then somehow the priest that ordained me was in that tradition. The present day tradition of that path is called the Longmen, the Dragon Gate lineage, the Dr Longmen. Longmen means dragon.
Okay.
So then I was ordained by this priest of the Longmen, and then when I started my lineage, so what I did, like many others, is not called a branch or a lineage, and that's the spreading of it. So this particular branch and lineage is more focused on the meditation, the deep. A lot of, again, a lot of words. Inner alchemy is a big catch-all that inner alchemy includes Qigong, and includes all different kinds of meditation practices, and includes studying the scriptures. So that's the path that I'm in. The inner alchemy, that's what Zoan is part of that tradition. And so then the other, like, even before the Chuanzen lineage or path, actually they're called like schools because it's a big group. It's not just a branch. The other big school, were celestial masters, and then that evolved to present day practitioners of that path. That's the Taoist path that is more ritual oriented.
Okay.
A lot of rituals. I know many people that have are priests in that tradition, and they learn a lot of rituals. They would be, in a way, they may be closer to the modern day or the Catholic priest, because Catholic services, a lot of ritual. So the celestial masters tradition has a lot of rituals, including exorcism. You know, sometimes they call it magic. So sometimes I get a call or contact someone thinks they're possessed, or they just have something going on that you know, the doctors can't diagnose and figure out, and they want to know if I could do some Taoist practices with them or teach them something or do, you know, send some something to rid them of whatever that is. And so I then say, that's not my path, my tradition, and I refer them to someone else that I know that it is their tradition. In my tradition, and me specifically, because if I was in China, there would still be a lot more ritual, even in the same lineage. But I have very little ritual. My biggest ritual, as a creator of the American Dragon Gate lineage, is more around when we have ordinations. Because that's taken very seriously by myself and my students. I mean, they've invested 3.5 to maybe 4.5 years of being with me, with the idea of eventually becoming an ordained priest. So the ordination is, it's not complicated. It's, you know, a full hour of things that we do, reciting things, reciting our special scriptures. There's clothes that they've purchased, their Taoist robes and shirts and these whisks. And so that's all part of the ceremony. There's vows that they take that are part of the, you know, my lineage, as they carry over, flow into the more ancient vows, you know, traditional ones. And so that's all done, you know, that's when we put on our robes, we change gears, you know, we're not, the people that are not part of the lineage, they're told, okay, got a 15-minute break while we set up, and we set up for a little ritual. There's blessings, you know, bowing and offering incense to the altar. There's blessing with the whisk. And then there's the ordination there. So that's the most ritual that I do.
Thank you for explaining that. It's fascinating. I, you know, I'm really edified and strengthened by your way of holding so much, that some might consider intention. Clearly it's not for you. And that's a testament to your commitment to non-dualism, which I really appreciate. So thank you for taking time to speak about so much that is really not meant for speaking, right? But for experiencing and being silent about. So anyway, great to have you, Michael, on the show.
Well, thank you. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk.
Yeah, absolutely. So people can find your webpage at QigongDragon.com. That's QigongDragon.com. Is there anything else you'd like to plug that you're up to right now?
Well, my books are very valuable. So if you go to my webpage, then you'll find my books. The written, you know, that I have a 600-page book that sums up the advice that one of the when I was ordained, there was a woman priestess that was part of the ceremony, and then we met privately, and she said, okay, now you have to go home and grow as a priest in the heart. And so that became the name of my the 600-page journal book is like actually four books in one, and it describes how does a Taoist grow in the heart. So that's the whole path: growing as a Taoist, growing as a person in the heart. That's the summary of it all.
Beautiful. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
I think simply reading the Tao Te Ching is probably the best place to start just to get a flavor of some of the ideas of Taoism if you never have before. But if you're curious to learn more about the vastness of the religion as a whole, I recommend the book I've read since these conversations, Taoism, An Essential Guide by Eva Wong. It's very good. It's not too long, but it is pretty comprehensive. Just to give a kind of a survey of the faith. It's fascinating to me how Thomas Merton once again shows up in the life of a person discerning Catholic spirituality and monasticism. Here we heard it with Michael Rinaldini, but of course we also heard it in Brad Malkowski's life, and the Jesus Prayer also came up in this episode as it did early on in the season with Frederica Matthews Green. So it's kind of cool to see that type of overlap. I'm also just so impressed at how many of our guests legitimately explore the world when they explore their vocation and spirituality. They have people literally traveling, you know, to the far-flung reaches of Asia in order to have these, you know, legitimate, authentic experiences. I also love, you know, just to go back to something I mentioned at the end of last episode, these things that we kind of have heard of and know something about, but maybe don't attribute them to Taoism. In this episode, we heard about Chinese medicine and, of course, Tai Chi and Qigong again. Just so fast. I mean, I don't know. I never associate it with a particular tradition. So I think it's very cool. And I think that the other thing that I heard in both episodes is just how important it is to have a single good teacher, a local teacher, to learn from. And I keep thinking about Michael's comment about the apophatic tradition within Christianity and how it echoes the Taoist understanding of non-dual, non-separation of everything. So just beautiful and deep, and kind of bringing together, you know, both, of course, Christian and Taoist traditions, but also Buddhism is right there with that idea. Next time, we are going to spend one episode hearing from a Christian who is also a Confucian and a scholar of Confucianism, Dr. Lauren Pfister. So join us next time for that. Religion to Reality is not just a podcast. It's an interfaith monthly gathering. We meet on the first Wednesday of the month. You can register at our Substack. There's a post about how to register on our Substack, which is religiontoreality.substack.com. And that's a great place to get in touch with us as well. Religion to Reality was created and is executive produced by me, Dave Plisky, and is produced and edited by Nick Stropoli and Connor Donnelly. You can find the show notes and other resources at religiontoreality.org. Subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.